Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. Just before we jump into the episode this week, I wanted to share a little bit about the Thrive community that I run. It's a place where many like-minded women go to connect and share their experience with getting and staying successfully sober. There are different sections, like the main Thrive community feed, where people post about things that are up and coming or about challenges they're facing, and they get incredible support from other members of the group. It really is a special, special place to be right now. There are also sections to share your milestones, because every win, even the really small ones, are a big thing to celebrate, and we acknowledge that. There are Thrive events, there are the weekly Zoom recordings, so you can go back and see all the weekly Zoom meetings and all the topics that have been covered in those meetings at your own leisure. There's a share sober tips section, and then there are group chats for the first 30 days, the first 100 days, the first year, and over a year. There's a knowledge hub as well, and in the knowledge hub you'll find a place for books and book recommendations. There's a section of how to survive the first 30 days, so if you come in completely brand new to getting sober, you can hit the ground running and find tools and information to get a structure set up for yourself from the outset. There's also my Thrive Sober program, there's a toolkit, there's understanding the brain science, and a space to read and learn about all the topics under emotional sobriety, most of which have been written by myself. So come into Thrive. If you're thinking about it or you're lacking community, I would say just jump in and go for it. And maybe we'll see you in there soon.
Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm going to be chatting with Penny, and she is a Midlands girl just like me, but is now living in Kingston upon Thames. She's 130 days sober, and in the bit before we pressed record, she said it was her second stint. So I'm really looking forward to getting into your story, Penny. Thank you so much for making the time for me today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to sharing with you.
Oh, good. So let's jump straight in. Tell us a bit about yourself, what you're doing for work. Yeah, what's your sort of setup at the moment?
So at the moment, I am 29 years old. So I'm in the eve of my 20s, I think. Is that how you say it? The eve of my 20s?
I don't know. It sounds quite poetic. I like it.
And I'm currently doing opiate recovery work at a drug and alcohol service in Camden. So I've been here just for a few weeks. I have been doing this kind of recovery work kind of since the pandemic, which doesn't line up with my sobriety at all. It's kind of been woven into its own journey together. And yeah, I'm also finishing my master's in public health, because I had, after working frontline roles for quite a while, I started to get quite frustrated at the way that policy, or the lack of understanding that frontline workers have in terms of policy and why we were being asked to do things. So I thought, why don't I just go back to university and find out how they make all these decisions for us and how we start acting them. So yeah, that's what I'm up to at the moment.
It's amazing. I love that. There's a lot on your plate there then.
Keeping very busy. Very busy
woman. Yeah. So talking about alcohol then, and I think it's so interesting as well, now that you obviously work in recovery as well, I'm really looking forward to exploring your story and how it weaves together. But yeah, talk us through your life with drinking. Where did that start, and kind of what did that look like?
So my life with drinking, I think, started at quite a general age for the UK. I imagine, you know, I don't remember my first drink. I don't remember how it made me feel or anything like that. But I remember drinking when we were younger. My parents would let us have these huge house parties, and everyone would drink. And there were some, you know, obviously now children, probably quite irresponsible, but children that would get far too drunk, and parents would, you know, be angry at our parents. But it was never something that was off limits in my childhood. And then moving into university, I really struggled. I went to university when I was 18. I really struggled with loneliness. And I think I kind of started to lean on alcohol, but again, didn't recognize that as an issue. There are some standout kind of blackouts and oblivion moments that I think probably should have been warning signs. And I think that they would crop up, you know, increasingly commonly as I got older and older, but at the time, probably like 3 or 4 times a year, and then moving on to, like, you know, almost every time I would drink. It probably got quite serious around my mid-20s, I think. I think that's when I started getting things in my life that I didn't want to lose. I'd never really been bothered before about losing anything. Like, I've been fired multiple times, some of those due to, like, the back end of a night out and, like, you know, not directly substance related, but, you know, definitely that was impairing stuff. But I didn't really have anything I cared about until I started, got into my mid-20s and started working with. So my original thing was actually to stop taking Class A's. I started volunteering at a mental health drop-in service, and I was given the option to volunteer on a Thursday evening or a Sunday morning. And I'd got into quite a bad habit of going out, and, you know, alcohol was heavily involved in that as well. But I chose to start volunteering on a Sunday morning because I needed some accountability to rein in my behaviour. And that was about, that must have been about 7 or 8 years ago. And that stopped me doing Class A's for years and years and years, just having that, like, accountability. But yeah, and then with alcohol, it just proceeded to blacking out almost every time. The shame, the regret, the hangovers were getting just, like, so terrible. I was calling in sick to work. I was also, you know, working as a recovery worker during that. I wasn't alcohol dependent, but definitely was struggling with my relationship with it. So yeah, I just started gaining things like my career that I really cared about, my relationships that I care about, my flat and tenancy that I really care about. And it just started to become clearer and clearer that I'd lost things like that before due to alcohol, but this time I really didn't want to lose them. So I think that's what kind of inspired the changes. Like, I'd proven to myself again and again that I was capable of blowing up my life, but it didn't really matter before because I could just rinse and repeat it.
Yeah.
Whereas I didn't want to blow this one up. So
yeah.
And fingers crossed, today I haven't done that.
Oh, fantastic. So talk to me about, you said you had a stint before. Yeah. When did the thought of maybe stopping start to creep in?
I think, so I actually found a Facebook status I'd posted. I must have been about 23. And it said, so this was 6-7 years ago. And it said, "I'm taking a break from drinking. If you see me holding a pint, slap it out of my hand." I don't remember doing that at all, but the thoughts must have been there really young. But I remember the time where I was toying with the idea because my hangovers were quite terrible. I think it didn't start getting serious, and it started to become every time I drank, to the point where even if I had one beer, I would get into bed and just berate myself, look for wondering why I would need to do that. I think it started to become clearer and clearer when I would start going to the pub on my own. And that would be, you know, I would take my laptop and say I was going to do university work, or I'd take a book and say I was going to read, but I wasn't, I was just going to drink.
Yeah.
And the first time I got sober, I was at a party in a pub that I didn't really want to be at. I'd had a rubbish day. And I was in the beer garden, and I so distinctly remember the thought went through my mind of, once I've had a few pints, this will feel so much better.
Mm.
And it was the first time I think I'd said it so clearly to myself that I got to bed that night and was like, I'm not doing it anymore. That is, like, I did not want to be there. Like, alcohol had stopped being a ticket to make, it stopped being making good, quote unquote, good situations better. And it started making situations I didn't want to be in bearable.
Yeah.
And I think that was a real moment where I just was not at all aligned with who I thought who I am inside. And there's only so long for me that I could keep acting like a person I didn't think I was, when if I was showing the world that, at what point does that become me? At what point can I keep arguing with myself that that's not actually who I am? Because all I'm doing is showing evidence that that is who I am. So that was the first time. I used the Try Dry app, which I loved. I loved the little like streamers that come up after every day when you do it. And I planned to do 100 days and then really just enjoyed it. Felt so much relief. And then didn't get any more support in terms of like mutual aid or AA or any groups or anything. So I think I just slowly, summer came and I slowly started planning my relapse, I think.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. What did that, when, you know, because that's quite a conscious thing, isn't it? Like I literally started planning it. What do you mean by that?
Well, I know exactly what it was. I was going on holiday with my friends to this house in Italy that we had been to multiple times before. And it's completely in the middle of nowhere. All it's got is a pool. And I had always been quite unsafe in my drinking behavior. So whether that had been like unsafe, risky sexual situations or, you know, being blackout, not remembering, losing cards, very kind of dangerous behaviors. And this is how, even with like 7 months of sobriety, this is, I can still feel my addict brain speaking, because I said to my friends, well, I was thinking this would be a really good time to drink, girls, because there's no shop I can go to. There's no men I can speak to. The worst thing that's going to happen is I'll drown in the pool.
Which, like, not bad.
Yeah. But thinking in my head, that's how I had thought.
You're justifying it.
Yeah. I need to be in a different place in the middle of nowhere with only women. And that is a safe place for me to drink. If that is a safe place for me to drink, like, that is so far beyond safety in terms of all the other options. And I did. I drank on that holiday. I was on SSRIs. Obviously, I'd had a break. My hangovers weren't very bad. And then I came back to the UK. I said it would only be for that. And my partner's stepdad completely forgot. He didn't know I was drinking again, but he just went up to the bar. We were with a load of family. He brought back a bottle of wine with three wine glasses, one for me, one for my stepsister-in-law, and one for my mother-in-law. And I looked at the glass, looked at him, and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And I said, "No worries, it's fine." And that was it. I was just back on drinking. Mm. And that lasted 9 months. Like, it was that thoughtless. Well, loads of thought went into the prep, and then actually continuing it was just so easy.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I think that's the frightening thing about it, isn't it? That, because I'm like you, I've had a couple of stints before this, this one, and it's just so easy to slip straight back in. And I think I found that quite shocking, actually. Yeah. I just sort of expected it to be different. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't. And I don't know about you, but I always felt like it was more of an issue after the stints of sobriety, weirdly. Like I felt like I was drinking more in some cases.
Oh yeah, I was really enjoying it. A friend of mine actually reminded me, I mentioned that I was going to be speaking to you, and she said, you know, I would never have told you this at the time, but she came to a party at my parents' house in September, and she said that she watched the amount I drank that night. And I remember that night her saying that she felt ill, and me thinking it was so rude that she would say she felt ill at my parents' party. Why won't she just have fun with everyone? And she said to me that the amount of alcohol she watched me put away was so worrisome to her that it like really impacted her night. And I think I wasn't recognizing, I was having a great time until the morning after, obviously. But yeah, I didn't realize that it was impacting the people I loved that much. And I'm really glad that she told me. So I think it probably, as someone who was looking in, it was probably a lot worse. I feel like I just let myself off the leash.
I remember doing that as well a lot to myself, always searching people's faces when I was having conversations, like, oh God, was I really bad? And just looking for evidence but just hoping that they would say, no, you were fine. It was fine. And just feeling that relief of, oh, okay, I was fine. But really I wasn't, you know, they're just being polite, or maybe they were drunk as well and no one really knows.
Oh. But I've said to people previously, if I'm asking you if it's all right, it's because I'm anxious. The only correct answer is that I was fine. Yeah. Take zero, like, I will take zero accountability for it. I don't want to hear it. That's why it's taken my friend, what, 8 months, 7 months to speak to me about what happened at my parents' house? Like, because I just would not listen to it. I don't want to know, because then I would just like victimize myself or weaponize that and make someone feel as if trying to ask me to take accountability was them punishing me for something I already felt bad for, knowing I would go and do it again anyway.
Yeah. It's very complicated, the relationship with alcohol and substances. You know, I was definitely into substances for long periods of my life when I had been drinking quite big, you know, big drinking nights. And that just always made me feel bad, made me feel horrible the next day, just so much regret. And, you know, the over drinking is bad enough, but the over drinking and then substances until 7 a.m. that's, oh, for God's sake, what's wrong with you? Why can't you, what are you doing? But there's just that ferocious appetite for it next time. And the drink fuels a lot of that. I don't know if you've been a smoker as well, but as a smoker, I would give up smoking and then I would drink. And then I would literally, as soon as I'd got my drink in my hand, I'd be sparking another cigarette, because the things just went hand in hand. I just couldn't, you know, alcohol was always the, you know, that was kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, like
the facilitator.
Yeah, it was like the ringleader. Yeah. Like, come on, now we're having a drink. Let's get all the other shit out. And it's just a horrible vortex to be in for a night.
Agree.
Yeah, there's nothing good about any of that behaviour. Nothing good. So you did 9 months, which, you know, is great, really, because it could have been longer. I always think to myself, I swear I moderated for about 10 years, which is nuts when I look back. But you definitely, you know, you got back into drinking, but 9 months later, you stopped. What made you stop again?
I, again, remember a crystal clear moment. I can remember more about choosing to be sober than I can about drinking. But it was a Thursday morning. It was a friend's leaving do. I had gone into Central to meet another friend in the morning, and I'd walked into Monsoon and Waterloo Station. Monsoon is so far out of my price bracket, but I love going in there. And they had this cardigan on sale. It was so nice. And I went to myself, you can buy this cardigan, because if you buy this cardigan, you can't afford to drink tonight. And I bought the cardigan, still wear it all the time to this day. Went to meet my friend for the walk and said, it's great because now I'm not going to drink tonight because I've just spent 40 quid on this cardigan, so I can't afford to. That already, wild thinking, but that's how I was like trying to control it by the end of that 9 months. So I go to the leaving do, I walk straight into the pub, I order a glass of white wine. I proceed to drink 6 of them. That goes completely out the window. Like, it was gone the minute, like, that was it. The dopamine of getting that thing, the reasoning was all straight out of my head. And the night goes on. It's a lovely night. Nothing bad happens. No severe consequences. But I kind of raise my head. All of my friends have left, apart from the girl who's leaving. I'm sitting with her housemate, who I don't know, and someone else who I don't know. And again, my internal monologue, I don't know what it is that's trying to save me all the time, but just says, the only reason you are here is because the bar is open. And I just got this like crashing weight of being like, I don't know what these people are talking about. All of my friends have gone. I'm literally here because the pub's open till midnight. Like, what? I can't believe I'm here again. Like, this is why I'm here. Why when I've got these great friendships and this flat that I keep going on about, and my partner that I say that I love, and I've got, you know, work to do that I say is really valuable to me, why am I here? Like, I've chosen it again. And that's like the cardigan thing is just completely out the window. So that was like, and then the next day, I was a Friday. My partner was meant to be going to rugby, our hometown. And I woke up and I was so upset with myself that I'd let it happen again. Because I wasn't even, there were no bad consequences. Do you know what I mean? Like outside consequences that they were past then. It was just beating myself up for it. And I looked up AA meetings and I thought, I'm going to go to one. I'm not going to tell anyone I'm going. Kind of part of me knew that it would be a good thing. And part of me had that will that, you know, people say they want to walk in and think, God, you're all terrible. I'm fine. And then, yeah, my partner, he spent the whole day on the sofa sleeping, feeling sorry for myself. And my partner wasn't going home. So I eventually had to tell him what I was doing. Because going out on a Friday night at 7 o'clock when your partner's away looks pretty sketchy if you don't tell him what you're up to. I just went to this meeting, cried the whole time, like identified a lot, and then that was the start of the end. I think I didn't have drunk since then.
Oh, it's amazing. That makes me have goosebumps, to be honest, like listening to the story. I find it fascinating that there's just a few thoughts can just change the course of your life forever.
Yeah,
you know, it's and thank God we get those thoughts, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've had many mornings where you woke up and felt that way, but that morning it was just the morning for you.
Yeah, it was just the day. And that's the thing, like, it's these thoughts, like the two times I've had these thoughts, like short sentences run through my head, the consequences I've had, because like that's another thing that scares me about my drinking, is my behavior got worse and worse. Like it got like cheating, it got aggressive, starting fights, like talking to myself, I kicked down someone's door. Like it's just been, I've done really wild things. So all of those consequences, it feels like there's always a line in the sand and I cross that every time. So how much worse does it have to get? But it just kept getting worse and worse, and that wasn't stopping me. So the fear of the saying I'll never do something, like all of the things I don't want to do, I've already done in the past. So they're not off the table. I could do them again. So I'm glad that I didn't have to go and cross another line to kind of have that realization, because it's not worth it. Like, it's just that, I'm glad I didn't wait for it to get,
yeah,
to destroy something big this time.
I really had the same sorts of thoughts. They terrified me. I think I also had some health anxiety as well that I didn't realize was health anxiety, but I was really worrying about the effect of alcohol and all the things were having on my body, knowing that I was approaching, you know, 40s, my 40s and then 50s. And I don't know, I just felt like, how long can you keep doing this before you're sitting in a doctor's office and something's gone terribly wrong? Something that you're going to feel like deep down you could have changed, perhaps, because if you'd just made some decisions about just made some good choices about the things that, you know, I loved what you said about the voice inside me that's trying to save me. I think we all get that voice. We all get that voice. And I don't know what it is about why some people listen and take, almost like take the guidance, take the inner guidance, and some people don't, you know. I mean, obviously I know that, you know, we hear what we want to hear, and there's all that kind of psychology, and then obviously denial is very strong and can be very strong in people, and I get all of that. But most of the people that I talk to, they talk about that deep knowing. It's almost like the version of them that they want to be aligned with, that they're not being, is really, yeah, screaming at the top of its voice, like, for God's sake, will you wake up? But why do some people listen to that and take action and some people don't? I find that really fascinating, to be honest. It's one of those kind of unanswered questions. I think if we had the answer to that, everybody would probably stop drinking.
Yeah, we could tune everybody into the same channel.
yeah, exactly. But there is that inner guidance, isn't there? There is that, just that inner feeling that you need to change, and it is quite visceral. I think when you listen to it and you take action, I do think you're rewarded, even if it's challenging. And so you did the meeting. What did you do? How did you get to where you are today? You know, you've got 130 days and what did you do? What sorts of things did you do? Talk to me about that process.
So personally, I think what it is I've made it a non-negotiable. And this did come up in it's taken a lot of work with friends, and like, I think that there is, and my partner, I think there's a bit of a grieving process around it, because I don't know what yours was like, but my shame was, as much as I could talk about it now openly, it was so internalized, and it was just, being me was a horrible place to be, but you wouldn't notice from the outside so much. Mm. Going to meetings regularly, engaging with people that haven't got a sponsor yet, and you know, for me that's fine. I go to very gentle meetings where there's a good core group of people. I've never been like, some people say they feel pressured and stuff, I've never felt like that. But just to continue to go, to remember how I felt, like to just, it's more so, you know, when people say play it forward and you play forward the next like 24 hours, that I do play it forward often, but I would say more, the thing that keeps it more grounded for me is every morning when I'm in the shower, I will think about how it feels to shower hungover. And I will think about what I would be doing if I had drunk last night. So I kind of play it forward, but then also play it backward. And I really try and feel like the gratitude for how that has felt, like to touch my face and not want to be sick, and for my eyes not to be really red. You know, like I used to keep eye drops in my desk drawer when I was 22 because I was drinking so much. Like, I'm so glad I don't have to do that anymore. And I think that gratitude is what's pulled me through this time. But there have been difficult moments. Like there was quite a big thing with my partner where this time around he had the realization, I think, that this is for real. And he said, you know, that he was grappling with some feelings of what life would look like for both of us. Because he said the first time he kind of always knew I'd start again, which was really sad for me to hear, but you know, I wasn't taking the preparation steps. I didn't have support around me. So maybe it was inevitable. You couldn't have told me that 130 days in last time, but maybe it was obvious. But that it feels like it's really serious this time. And he said that he was mourning the idea that we'll never have a beer on the beach together. Mm. If we go to a day festival, you know, like I'll probably end up leaving early, or I'll probably end up wanting to go late, we'll never be on the same level again. And my reaction to that, I think, really shocked me, because I just sat there and went, okay, that's fine. And I realized that that's how important my sobriety was in that conversation. Cause I was like, I am willing, I don't want to, but for my life, like I am willing to potentially lose that for my sobriety, cause I'm not going back there. And I think that show of commitment was quite strange probably to him, but we decided to work through it and it seems to be working so far. Mm. So yeah, there's definitely been hiccups. Like, and then that night I went to a meeting and did woe is me, why can't I be in a pub right now drinking? Why can't I be the fun, sexy girlfriend? But, you know, I can be those things, I'm just not going to be drinking when I'm doing it. And I actually don't think I ever was the fun, sexy, drunk girlfriend. I was the shouting at you on the train girlfriend. So yeah, that's how I think, just that pure gratitude. It's just so not worth it.
Yeah. Oh, And actually, I had a similar conversation with my partner early on, even though he's not actually a big drinker.
Neither's mine. That's the weird thing.
He's not a big drinker, but I think when he realised I was quite, you know, very serious about not drinking, he definitely had that moment of adjustment where he had to accept that whatever the vision or, you know, the vision or illusion in his head was, that he said, oh, we're never able to have a pina colada together again, you know, on the beach. We'd literally had one once in our lives.
Yeah.
but I do understand that, you know, felt like, oh, it felt like he was losing something. And if I'm being honest, I felt back then like I was losing something as well. You know, I was dealing with grief of letting that version of me go, of never being able to rely on that crutch again, of thinking about those really kind of far-fetched, distant, you know, my kids getting married.
Yeah.
You know, at the time they were like three. You know, getting married and me not being able to, and just feeling very much in that scarcity mindset. Mm. But, you know, fortunately, as you keep going and as you keep working and keep doing all of these sorts of things, especially those mental tools like playing it forward or playing it back, you know, I really like, I do a lot of playing it back as well, or playing it out now, as in if I'm in an event or I'm doing something and people are drinking, I will always think, what would it be like for me right now? What would I be doing in this situation? And I know what that version of me looks like. And it's never good, even though I think in the beginning, I definitely felt like she was fun, she was great, she was the one that everyone loved. she was a pain in the ass. Do you know what I mean? She got me into trouble and she made stupid mistakes and she made me hate myself. So yeah, it's just really interesting when you, I think when you detangle all of that and remove all the romanticism and the illusion from it. And that process is a grieving process for both sides. But then now the conversations with him are like, isn't it so great that I don't drink? And he says, I don't even know if we'd be together if you were still drinking. Yeah. And it's just such a huge positive in our relationship, because actually he doesn't drink a lot. In fact, he's decided, you know what, I don't want to drink either anymore. And wow, that's not for any pressure from me at all. Yeah. I just think he thinks it's a bit cool.
It's by osmosis. It is by osmosis.
Yeah. I just think he thinks it's quite, like, he quite likes the fact that, no, I just won't drink. I mean, what's the point of drinking? You know, I don't really get any value from it. So, yeah, that's kind of really kind of done a, you know, 360. But when you were talking about your sobriety before, comparing that to where you are now, I think the thing that always stands out for me is it's the value that we place on alcohol. And probably in the first stint, there was still that value mm-hmm. attached to drinking, even though you're, you know, not wanting to drink and you're trying to cut it. And it, but when you still hold it in that high regard, which we do, right, because social conditioning and all the things, it's really hard to get away from desiring it or you know, feel like you're missing out if you're not having it. And I do think that when you get into the right gear with sobriety and you kind of, you have that real, that very strong intention, and you have, and you're not afraid to have those kinds of conversations, which are, hey, guess what? I'm going to actually put myself first now. Mm-hmm. That's what I need. I need to have my own back in life, and I need to stop doing things that please other people or whatever the things are. I just feel like you start, that value piece really starts to crumble and break down, because you start to realize that you're not gaining anything from drinking alcohol anyway. Like going to an event or going to a situation, go to a wedding. When I'm in a wedding, I think the last thing I want on earth now is to drink alcohol, because yeah, it's not going to give me anything. Like, I genuinely yeah, believe that. And so I think that value piece is really, it's hugely important. But from your point of view, what do you think is different this time?
I think what is different is, to be honest, I do think part of it is the accountability of going to meetings. I think I was only accountable to myself before. And I think when I spoke earlier about my early 20s and doing the volunteering on the Sunday morning, I'm the kind of person that if I want to get fit, I go to a gym class. I can't get AI to write me a script and go to the gym every day, because I won't do it. If I want to, you know, stay healthy or whatever, like, I need to be doing it with someone. I like, if I'm the best I ever am at reading my book is when I'm on the tube, because once I've got my book out in my head, I'm like, well, you have to read now because you have to prove to everybody in the carriage that you can read your book. So it's that I need that sense of community. Yeah. And I think that I could have decided that Friday when I woke up and thought, I'll go to an AA meeting, I could have decided to just not go out and drink because it was a Friday night. I'm sure there was probably some plan going on. And I could have decided that on the Saturday and the Sunday and the weekend after that and the weekend after that. But there was no accountability coming from the people around me. Mm. You know, they won't mind and they want to be supportive and they don't want to enable it, but they don't want to say anything. You know, like, when I first quit drinking, one thing I did really notice is that none of my friends, my girlfriends, mourned me drinking. And that was a big sign for me that, so drinking me isn't this great character that everyone yeah, is going to love and really miss.
Yeah.
And I think now what's different this time is definitely I want to go to meetings and I want to get my chip. I want to be there and I want to be able to look people in the eye. Not that there's any shame in lapsing or relapsing. Like, it happens to everyone. You know, I've done it. Like, it happens to so many people. And, you know, like we said, it's part of the process sometimes. But for me, being able to look the people who are like years and years sober in the eye when I walk into that room, who I see almost every week, and know that I'm still there, that's so important to me right now, holding that. Mm. I think that's, yeah, these strangers who aren't strangers anymore, but these people are just, if they can do it, I can do it, you know. And
yeah,
I think that's what's really different this time. I just needed a community.
I think it's fantastic that you've identified that as well. And maybe someone listening to that might connect with that and think, ah, that's maybe what I need. Because some people's journey is that they stop and start lots of times. And I do think that that then compounds that shame, frustration, anxiety, that, you know, you can't drink very well and now you can't not drink very well either. And it's horrible, isn't it? And I see that a lot in my community as well, people. But I do think that having that accountability can be just so life-changing. And I think knowing as well that there are other people struggling with the same things, mm-hmm. it just humanizes it, doesn't it? Because I think drinking, there is so much shame. I went into sobriety, I had a huge cloud of shame, really did, especially with a partner who doesn't drink a lot, mm-hmm. who would admit that in the early days, he just couldn't get why can't you just have one? And why can't you take it or leave it? And why do you need to just quit completely? Like, that was very extreme behavior to him. And it was only when I took the time to really explain what drinking was like for me, even because he didn't really physically see a lot of it, but it's the mental side of things, like the thinking about drinking, thinking how to drink well so that I meet all my own rules, and, you know, all of that mental gymnastics. And then the agonizing about people pouring drinks too slow and about needing to maybe be the designated driver. I mean, that would mean it would ruin my night. And then it's just all of that stuff. I think once I'd managed to share some of that, I definitely think it took some of that shame away, because he said, "Oh, right, okay, I get it now. You don't, you know, you drink in that way and it's very different to me. And actually, if I was drinking like you, I would feel the same way
that
you did. I would need to stop. I wouldn't be able to cope with that." And that was like, ah, right, okay. But sometimes I don't think that, you know, people don't get it, do they? Like, until you've been in that world, I don't think you really understand it. People see life through their own lens, don't they? Through their own pattern.
Oh my God. Much like I cannot understand. So I heard a friend told me a story that she went out for after work drinks at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I think it was, right, with her boss. And she was having dinner with a friend at 7. She said that she drank 2 glasses of wine and she could feel herself getting a bit drunk. So what she decided to do was order a glass of water, get a meal deal, and have a little sit in the park, because she didn't want to be drunk for dinner with her friend at 7, because she, obviously it's rude to turn up pissed. That to me is the most alien behavior. If someone said to me, "Do you want to go for drinks at 2 o'clock in the afternoon?" I'd be absolutely steaming by dinner. It would not even cross my mind about like it being polite or impolite to do that. I would be on one, but an excuse to drink early. The earlier I started, even the earlier I was going to bed, or the more I was drinking.
Yeah.
Like,
same.
And I very similarly to what you're saying about your partner saying like about not understanding it. My partner said something to me where he was like, "But I've seen you have a couple of drinks and come home." But what you haven't seen is the inside, where I'm going, "Oh God, I'd love a drink right now, but I'm really proving to myself that I'm being so good. Look at me just having a couple of drinks in the afternoon." Like that monologue just going in my brain.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
And God, so wild.
Yeah, I know. And I think when you stop drinking, you shut that noise down.
Yeah.
And it is unbelievably restful in your head. Because of that, it's almost like, oh God. And then you start to think, how did I ever put up with that for so long? And just all of that chatter, all related to making sure that you drink okay, making sure that you don't drink too much, making sure you have enough nights off in the week, making sure, you know, all of that stuff, which was a bit roulette anyway. How do you actually ever really meet your own expectations? Mm-hmm. Hardly ever. But yeah, it's I'm the same. I think being that kind of no off switch drinker, really. It's like, well, if we're going to go out for drinks at lunch, I'm drinking till I go to bed.
Oh my God, totally. I don't, why would you want to like get the taste of feeling drunk and not want to run towards oblivion? Like, yeah, that's, you're at the start of the race, like, go.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. And in actual fact, I used to feel quite proud of that as well. I'd remember that I would say, yeah, no, if you start drinking, then that's it. We carry on drinking. And it feeling a bit like a badge of honour, you know, you don't have a drink or two and then go on to tea. Who does that? Who does
I
that?
Know.
I mean, actually, a lot of people.
Everyone
do
else.
Yeah, a lot of people do that, to be fair. But that was very. I always drank to get drunk. That was it.
Oh yeah, drunk for as long as possible.
Yeah. Yep. And it was always just like, because I don't know about you, but I felt like I just used to get quicker and quicker with my drinking as well. So, you know, it would. I could polish off a large glass of wine in half the time it would take the rest of the table to finish their wine.
Oh my God, I know. And doesn't it feel so uncouth to do that? That used to bring me so much shame. Like that's, I say that a bit tongue in cheek, but when I would look around with an empty pint glass, I'd be like, God, I am not a woman. I am not a lady drinker. I can't believe I've done this again. And even that would bring me shame. I was getting exactly what I wanted, but I was still feeling ashamed.
Yeah, I know. But people never seem to drink quickly enough for me. And the worst was when I would think that when people were topping up wine at dinner parties or things like that, and I'd think, did they on purpose? Did they leave a little bit out on purpose? Like, are they trying not to give me a full glass? Because everyone else looks like they've got slightly more and being really fixated on that. And I, you know, that's quite shameful. They're just being so fixated on, have they had a milliliter more than me? You know, and are they doing that for a reason? And like, just all this anxiety and overthinking, creating all of this narrative, when really they're just not hyper-focused on whether we've all got exactly the same amount in our glass, you know?
Oh, my God. I got told off once on holiday with my boyfriend's family. So we've done the same holiday, weirdly, repeat holiday again, but I've done it once drunk and once sober. And the time we did it drunk, we were sitting down at a restaurant. There were six of us. Three of us wanted wine. I asked for a large glass of red. It was decided that because three of us were going to be drinking it, even though one person, my like sister-in-law, said that she wanted a small. And the bottle came to the table and I got it and I proceeded to empty a third of that bottle into my glass and was like kind of like scolded for it because people drink differently. But I remember being so offended and turning around and being like, well, I ordered a large. And in my head, pouring a third of that bottle is mine because that is what I ordered, so it is going straight into my glass. None of you are going to get your mitts on it. Like it was wild, like such...
It's quite selfish, isn't it? It's quite selfish behaviour.
A large glass was the largest I could order. You know, I couldn't get a bottle to myself, but if I'm ordering a large and you've ordered a small, I'm going to make sure I get exactly a large glass in my glass. So, you know, so I'm not getting any less. It's feeling shortchanged.
Feeling shortchanged. That sums it up perfectly. Yeah. That's right. And it's like feeling shortchanged about what, you know. Ooh. it's just blows my mind now, to be honest. But then when you stop drinking, you do change, your brain changes. And I think that's the wonderful thing about brains is you know, all this neuroplasticity. You can change your thinking, you can rewire it. What was once your normal can feel abnormal, and vice versa. Not drinking in situations for me now is my happy place. It's my default. It's my normal wiring.
Yeah.
It's where I feel safe. Like, I can't imagine drinking alcohol now and how unsafe that would make me and my nervous system, just everything physically, how it would make me feel. Which blows my mind, because actually just over five years ago, I was drinking four or five times a week.
Yeah.
And really prioritizing it and telling myself that I loved it. And on that note of loving things, what's been the best bit about you not drinking?
I think the best bit for me is being trustworthy. Yeah. I have, and especially to my mum. So my mum doesn't actually drink. She's not an alcoholic. She's not very open, but about like why she doesn't drink. She just doesn't drink. Yeah. I've seen her drink like twice in my life. Anyway, being reliable to her, because the more meetings I've done and the more I've heard people speak about their experiences and the more I've reflected on my own experience, there have been so many times where I've really let my mum down in drinking, and it's always been to do with drinking. Saying, you know, going to my hometown and saying I'll be back and then not coming back. Like, I used like a family bereavement as an excuse to go on a bender. Like, this one time my mum booked us a family photo shoot and told me the night before, please don't drink too much the night before. And I proceeded to do that and was late and it was horrible and a mess. And, you know, I grew up with my mum, and I'm so lucky to have had this, where every time I call my mum for advice, she's not a couple of glasses of wine down. She is speaking from a sober place for everything. If I need her to come and get me, if I need to like lean on her for something, she's consistent. And the best thing for me is that she's dedicated, you know, the first 30 years of my life to being reliable and consistent. And now she's in her 60s. I get to dedicate the next 30 or so years of my life to her, to being consistent for her. Mm. And that is just really like what I look forward to. For friends as well, definitely. But particularly for my mum, like the consistency she's given me, I just can't wait to continue to prove to her, because she never shamed me for my drinking. She never, you know, like I said earlier, we had huge house parties, but my mum would always be in the house upstairs and she'd drive everyone who was sick home. She'd speak to everyone's parents, you know, she'd make sure we were as safe as possible. I just can't wait to give that back to her.
Oh, so lovely. That's, yeah, as a parent as well, a parent that has stopped mm-hmm. drinking before my children will have any memory of mm-hmm. it. I feel a lot of gratitude that I might be able to offer my children the same experience. It's really interesting hearing you talk about that. And I think that's also quite different from my life. So my mom was a big drinker, drank every night, was always unreliable and chaotic. Mm. And you didn't know what version of her you would get at the end of the phone or face to face. And that's been quite destabilizing in my life. Mm. She's not around anymore, but you know, there are still many ghosts from that part of my life that I have to kind of walk alongside, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I have an experience of not having, of having the opposite of what you talk about. Mm. And I very much want to create your experience with my own family. And I feel like getting sober is going to allow me to do that, and that just feels really, yeah, it's quite close to my heart actually. It made me feel quite emotional listening to you were so beautiful the way that you described it, and just how grateful and appreciative you are. It really made me think, I get that opportunity as well, and actually that's all I want to be able to do, is to be happy and to be there for my family and to do my best.
It is very cool. Like, I didn't realize it until I got into this sobriety, but when they speak in like AA about like your higher power, like it's just becoming more and more apparent to me. Like, I think the people I see at AA are so bored of me talking about my mum, because it's all I talk about. I think she might be my higher power. Mm. And she as well, she's so cold. Like, she just does not. I call her after a meeting and tell her, oh, I spoke about you again. And, you know, I just want to remind you how grateful I am. And like, I'm making this promise to you. She's like, it's fine. Don't worry. It's just what you do. Oh, mum, just take it.
She's downplaying it.
Yeah.
I love that. I can't imagine if that were happened to me. I think I'd probably just start crying if my kids showed me that amount of appreciation. Because, you know, I don't know. It's I don't know. Does that happen? I guess it does. You're living proof of it. I think that's really lovely. And your mum's very lucky, as I'm sure you are, to have her. I think that's really lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. And so what would be your top three tips in getting or staying successfully sober?
My top three tips. So I think number one would be, as we spoke about previously, listen to that little voice. When that voice comes into your head, the easiest thing to do is to drown it out and to wait until next time, and it will, and it won't get quieter, but you will be able to just drown it and drown it and drown it. If it comes to you or you've noticed it, I mean, obviously there's no better time than today, but the next time it comes to you, really try and listen to that. And I would say, to even though I didn't get support in the first time I got sober, I like person to person support, I would set a goal. Just set yourself a goal, 7 days. If you do 7 days once a month for a whole year, you've done a quarter of a year. And then maybe you can look at moving that barrier. Secondly, would be to get support, I think. That's just from my personal experience. And, you know, I described who I am as a person. And I think if, you know, if anyone who listens identifies with that idea that if you want to get fit, you have to book a class. The AA is, or, you know, any kind of fellowship meeting, whichever one you might go to, obviously I'm going to recommend my experience, but no one there is there to judge you. Like, you might think that you've got nothing in common with these people, but, you know, that you will usually have something. And I think it can be really supportive. No one's going to sign you up for a 12-week course of mutual aid. So it's, you've got to like do it off your own back, but I think that can be very helpful. And then I suppose, similarly to like you said about rewiring your brain and neuroplasticity, I would suggest rewiring your algorithm if you're on social media. Something that is so useful, I think, for me is like, obviously how I came to find your podcast and your Instagram is through social media, and that's through my algorithm consistently feeding me these messages of sobriety and recovery. Seeing those has been so important for me because it just reminds me that someone else is doing it. So I don't know if this is a good time to mention, but I also run my workshops on the side. So I am by profession a recovery worker, working in drug and alcohol recovery. My journey has been kind of weaved in throughout that, which has been quite messy. I wouldn't recommend anyone be a recovery worker who's still drinking with a bad relationship with alcohol. But I now run sessions for people privately that I wish I'd had when I was younger, which are alcohol awareness workshops. I go into workplaces and talk to people about alcohol awareness, the good and bad things about drinking. And this is based off a survey that I did in 2023, which came back with some really interesting data around, one of the questions was, if you're to go to lunch with a superior, like a boss, and you weren't planning on drinking that day, but your boss orders a glass of wine, do you feel a silent social pressure to also order a drink? And 40% of the people came back and said that they would feel a pressure to order a drink. Because I do think that that is something that's woven into it. The idea that I would feel as if ordering a Coke while someone else is drinking is almost a social snub in some settings. So now I go into workplaces and talk to people about that. Just what I wish I'd have known. And in part of that, I run an Instagram for it as well. And there's a load of hot, sober celebrities that are not drinking. So I like to think about the fact that obviously I have a partner, but, you know, if I was out and I bumped into Jack Harlow, who is a sober celebrity, would I like to bump into Jack Harlow sober, or would I like to bump into him pissed? I would definitely like to bump into him sober, because that would maximize the chances of us getting a date. So in my head, when I do feel pressure, I do like to run through a list of like hot celebrities that I aspire to be around and think about the fact that they would appreciate my time better sober, even if the people I work with or friends of friends think it's uncool that I don't drink.
What a great tool. I love the mental tools that you have created for yourself. It's amazing to turn away from the crowd and just say, enough. Do you know what? What I signed up for is not what I'm getting here.
100%. And I really think that we're not as small a minority as we think we are. I just think that there are so many people who haven't either accessed this algorithm, haven't accessed the resources, or like, you know, are too entrenched in that, that they haven't come to this point yet. But there's no way that the way we were feeling when we were waking up, so many, I just believe that so many people feel that way.
I agree.
And, you know, for me, it was working in the recovery sphere. Like, AA was such a normal thing for me. So many of my colleagues are in recovery. You know, I was really lucky in that sense that I had that support and no one was judgmental. But I think about friends of mine or peers or whatever who I just truly believe they must feel the same, but it's not part of their daily life to talk about sobriety or options. And I think like that's why what you're doing and like myself coming on stuff like this is, like you said, hopefully it reaches someone who hasn't got that avenue in their life.
Yeah, definitely. So how can we find you? You mentioned about your Instagram. What is your Instagram so people can find and follow
you? Yes, so my Instagram is at Good Fridays. So that's G-O-O-D and then Fridays, which is F-R-I-D-A-Z-E.
Excellent.
So it's not religious. It's meant to be a take on Thirsty Thursdays, but it does sound quite religious.
Love it. Thank you so much for coming on and for the work that you do as well. And yeah, for sharing your story and huge well done on 130 days. I get that vibe that for you, it feels very different this time around and that, you know, and it's exciting. You know, I did this. I'm still excited about my sobriety because every year it keeps giving. It keeps giving and giving and giving. And so, you know, having done 130 days and got to 6 months and 12 months, and I feel like there's so much enjoyment and there's so much to learn and grow from on that journey. And that's all to come for you. That's really
exciting. I know. It's really exciting.
It's really cool. I really appreciate you coming on and please stay in touch. I want to hear about those milestones and the good work that you're doing. So I'm definitely going to come and follow Good Fridays in a moment. So thank you so much. And to everybody else who supports the show, thank you very, very much. See you next week.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.